Please be seated. Right. We are now going to hear from Beetham Lamb. Miss Phillips.
Hello.
So have you got an opening submission?
Yes, Your Honour, I have.
Yep.
And Mr. Moore has kindly agreed to assist me with swearing the witnesses.
Oh, yep, that's fine.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and have you printed that off?
Yes, you have.
Got it. Okay.
Yes.
We're in your hands.
So, may I please court? Thank you for the opportunity to be heard in relation to Beetham Lamb New Zealand and Dairy Industry New Zealand, or DINZ, submissions on the proposed Plan Change 7 to the Regional Plan Waterborough-Otago, or the plan. My name is Lauren Phillips. I'm the Environment Policy Manager for the South Island for Beetham Lamb New Zealand. Beetham Lamb is an industry good body funded under the Commodities Levy Act through a levy paid through the producers on all cattle and sheep slaughtered in New Zealand. Its mission is to deliver innovative tools and services to support informed decision-making and continuous improvement in market access, product positioning and farming systems. DINZ is a levy-funded industry good body established by the Dairy Industry New Zealand Regulations 2004 under the Primary Products Marketing Act 1953. Its vision statement is to promote and assist the development of the New Zealand dairy industry, a strong, stable, profitable industry for all participants. DINZ levy payers are producers and processors of venison and velvet. As already detailed in our submissions on PC7 for May 2020, deer farming has a number of affinities with the sheep and beef sector, and in fact about 80% of deer farmers also farm other livestock species. Both organisations are actively engaged in environmental issues that affect the pastoral production sector and in building farm-specific capability and capacity in these areas to ensure that the industry supports an ethos of environmental stewardship together with a vibrant, resilient and profitable sector. Maintaining, and where degraded, enhancing the health of fresh water, aquatic habitats, biodiversity across the region is important to the people of the Otago region. It is important to our economy and it is important to farmers. The sheep and beef sector alone employs approximately 92,000 people in full-time equivalent roles nationally. Dry stock farms, or farms where livestock are raised for meat, are an integral component of the Otago primary sector, and they contribute significantly to the region's economy, communities, landscape, and culture. PC7 has the potential to affect the dry stock sector, particularly extensive farm systems, disproportionately to the sector's environmental impact and would have the effect of regulation for regulation's sake rather than for environmental benefit. Beetham Lamb and DINZ have submitted that there are numerous issues with the proposed plan which affect dry stock farmers, for which stated relief is sought within the original submission. This statement builds on the substantive issues raised there and introduces the background for Beetham Lamb and DINZ expert witnesses. I'm speaking to the submissions made by Beetham Lamb and DINZ to PC7 submitted for May 2020. Beetham Lamb and DINZ submitted mostly in opposition to PC7, and this statement will focus on the three main issues where Beetham Lamb and DINZ have opposed provisions in the plan. These issues include the purpose and approach of the plan change and provisions which grandparent water use and therefore nutrients, and solutions to the issues within the plan change. The effects of the proposed provisions in PC7 may be intergenerational, potentially devastating to many dry stock systems, disproportionate or blind to the actual risk an activity poses to the environment, and therefore without real benefit to the environment. The purpose of PC7 was to address the Otago Regional Councils, or the Councils, looming problem of 1,080 water permits, or more than 50% of the region's water permits, expiring before a full plan review can be completed. It is envisaged that a full plan review would reconsider water allocation across the regions, and water use in some areas might need to be reduced once the appropriate modelling has been done. PC7 was supposed to provide an interim regulatory framework, a solution for water users to continue operating legally without rendering any future water allocation changes impotent. Beetham Lamb and DINZ support that intent to ensure that the council is not faced with having to replace more than half of its region's water permits on long-duration permits before it can determine how much water and where and for use by whom is sustainable on a sub-catchment level. In light of that intent, it is not appropriate to use this plan change as an opportunity to claw back water allocation, grandparent land use, undermine land value, and establish a nutrient allocation framework outside of the proper process and with the scientific, economic, social, and consultation guidance to do so through the full plan review. Provisions like Policy 10A.2.1, reinforced by Rules 10A.3.1.1 and 10A.3.2.1, purport to do exactly that, however. Furthermore, Otago is startlingly diverse in its landscapes, conditions, and climates, even at a subcatchment level. The Council's Section 32 Evaluation Report for Plan Change 7 acknowledges this when it mentions that some areas of the region are over-allocated for water use and some are not. Reducing water allocation for permit holders who may be using that water has permanent, not interim, effects on the permit holder. They are extremely unlikely to ever regain lost water. The broad brush approach of this plan change will result in permit holders losing water allocation, even in freshwater management users where water is not over-allocated. On the second topic, grandparenting provisions. PC7 should allow for water use, land use, and development which have been legitimately undertaken within the bounds of a valid permit. Provisions like Policy 10A.2.1, reinforced by Rule 10A.3.1.1 and 10A.2.1, do the exact opposite. Those provisions have the effect of grandparenting land and water use, and therefore nutrients. Grandparenting sometimes needs a little clarification, and its effects, the approach and its effects can be understood through an analysis of Farmer A and Farmer B and their land use or nutrient losses as modelled through Overseer. So, for example, in 2019, Farmer A's nitrogen number was 68 kgs of nitrogen per hectare per year. Farmer B's N number was 12 kgs of nitrogen per hectare per year. Both farmers are grandparented to those 2019 N numbers and may not increase over them. That is grandparenting. They are also then required to make 10% reductions in their nitrogen losses as modelled in Overseer. At 68 kgs of N per hectare per year, Farmer A's system is a high-impact, high-risk, intensive system and would generally have high inputs. There are a number of inefficiencies which can be addressed in a farm with such a high N number. And even when Farmer A has tweaked these inefficiencies to achieve a 10% reduction, the system still leaches 61 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. It is still a high-impact, high-risk, intensive system with a high N number. At 12 kgs of N per hectare per year, Farmer B's system is a low-impact, low-risk, and reasonably extensive system with low inputs. While system changes or cycles may occasionally slightly increase the N number, there are few inefficiencies in that system, and the farmer will likely already be farming to the natural limitations of the land. Failure to observe those limitations would already have resulted in environmental collapse, usually seen in soils, and or stock would have starved, or the business would have failed. This means that there is little that Farmer B can do to further reduce from 12 kgs of N per hectare per year to achieve the 1% reduction. The 1 kilogram reduction. Farmer B is also less able to respond to market demands, changes in technology, drought, or make any changes in the farm system because Farmer B's N number is too low to allow for any flexibility within the system without the risk of increasing nitrogen losses by at least a couple of kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. Off-farm, relative land prices are affected because the potential that Farmer B's land had in terms of land value is diminished because Farmer B can never intensify, even if Farmer B never intended to anyway. This reduces the equity Farmer B holds in the land and reduces the farm's resilience because there is less equity to borrow against to replace infrastructure, buy feed in a drought, upgrade to water reticulation in response to stock exclusion regulations, or tie the farm over in a year where prices are low. Farmer A's land is not affected in the same way, and the higher the N number, the more flexibility the land has, and therefore the more value the land has. This is how grandparenting has affected Canterbury in reality. with the effects most keenly experienced in areas like North Canterbury, with a divide between extensive, often hill and dry land, and intensive, often flat and irrigated, is pronounced. The dry stock sector is overwhelmingly farmer B. As Dr. Crystal has shown us in her evidence, the sheep and beef sector is a lower risk, low impact system, and this is the case even with the most intensive or irrigated sheep and beef systems. They are disproportionately adversely affected by the grandparented nutrient allocation system. Grandparenting nutrients is inherently inequitable. It rewards land users who have had the greatest impact on the environment while penalizing land users who have had the smallest impact on the environment and have been farming within the natural limits of their land. A grandparenting framework effectively allows high-impact systems to continue having a significant impact on the environment. In RMA terms, the concept of grandparenting is normally about specifically recognizing or providing for activities that already exist to continue producing their existing levels of effects, either permanently or for a defined period, but imposing immediate obligations on new entrants. It is understandably favored by existing operators who rationalize it by reference to their prior investment. For these reasons, Beef and Lamb and Dins oppose grandparenting frameworks. The submitters support a controlled activity status for permits to replace deemed and water permits due to expire before 2025. Beef and Lamb and Dins do not support conditions and matters of control which have the effect of grandparenting water use, land use, and therefore nutrients. In particular, Beef and Lamb and Dins oppose 10A3.1.13.
Can you just pause there whilst I dial that up?
Yes, actually, if you look at the joint, I'm going to work from the joint witness statement version just for ease of use.
So that's the 8th of April 2011?
Yes, yep. Yes.
And so you oppose the controlled activity rule, Roman numeral 3, which is the application demonstrates total area does not exceed the maximum area irrigated.
Yes, we actually also oppose 10A21B, which is the equivalent in the policy. Because it's pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that provision grandparents land the area of land under irrigation. As already submitted, the purpose of this plan change is not to determine land use or nutrient allocation. The purpose, as stated on page 5 of the Section 32 evaluation report for this plan change, is to provide an interim regulatory framework to provide for the assessment of applications to take and use water, specifically water permits that are due to expire before 2025. Rule 3A3.1.13 also fails to provide for development which may have been within the bounds of the existing permits since the grandparenting date, which might have increased land area under irrigation, for example, from a less efficient irrigation type to a more efficient irrigation method, for example, to pivot irrigation. This robs the permit holder of any development and investment post-notification. PC7 should allow for water use, land use, and development which have been legitimately undertaken within the bounds of a valid permit. The use of a non-complying activity status for those who cannot meet grandparenting provisions in Rule 10A3.1.1 is unduly harsh. It will be nearly impossible to obtain a resource consent, especially in light of Policy 10A2.2.1, which requires the Council to avoid granting resource consents where there has been an increase in area under irrigation. Ms. Maher's evidence proposed restricted discretionary rule to address the issue of irrigators who cannot meet the grandparenting provisions of Rule 10A.3.1. Beef and Lamb New Zealand and DINS note that a restricted discretionary activity, Rule 10A.3.1A, and it's supposed to be 0.1, has been accepted following various negotiations and discussions through the hearing process to date. Rule 10A.3.1A does not address the injustices mentioned in the statement, however. Elsewhere in New Zealand, impending regulation change, notably where nutrients are likely to fall under a grandparent allocation framework, as in Canterbury, has resulted in an accelerated intensification of land use in order to preempt restrictive regulation or to secure flexibility in the land use and value in the land. Beef and lamb and DINs do not support this gold rush approach and do not consider it to be conducive to achieving the environmental benefits that regulation appears to be intended for. As stated previously, however, PC7 should allow for water use, land use and development which have been legitimately undertaken within the bounds of a valid permit. Irrigators who would like to transition to more efficient irrigation systems, which, as Dr. Crystal's evidence details, result in an increased area of irrigation without necessarily increasing contaminant losses to the environment or increased water use, should be encouraged to do so. Otago has a high number of border dike or flood irrigation still in use, and between the cost of changing to a more efficient system and the prospect of applying for a non-complying activity resource consent, there is no incentive for farmers to change to systems with a lower environmental impact. Furthermore, a pathway should be provided for those land users who had embarked on the journey to change their irrigation system in some way or form, but had not completed it by the date that PC7 was notified. More efficient irrigation systems are expensive and require a great deal of planning, financing, and even changes to the farm system. Beyond the primary infrastructure itself, a farm may need to refence, retrain staff, adjust fertilizer plans, and change stock distribution and grazing rotations. The process of changing, for example, from border dike irrigation to spray irrigation can take several years. Farms which are undergoing succession changes, where grown children are buying the properties from their parents to take over the farm, are unable to mobilize funds with any speed or even to start the process to upgrade infrastructure. Ultimately, Beef and Lamb New Zealand and DINs consider that eliminating those parts of all provisions which have the effect of grandparenting water use, land use, and therefore nutrients would resolve the fundamental problems with the Plan Change 7 discussed above. Dry stock farmers are key to the fabric of the Otago region. They are there for the long haul, and family is the primary reason behind on-farm decisions. Dry stock farming systems are predominantly low-risk activities, and regulation that applies to these systems should reflect the level of risk. To remain a resilient, vibrant, and diverse sector, dry stock farmers require flexible land use and the ability to optimize their farming business within the environmental limits of their property. Beef and Lamb and DINs seek, broadly, that PC7 is amended to ensure that land use and ancillary objectives, policies, and methods, including rules, recognize and provide for the dry stock sector farming operations, including 1. Diversity of systems, soil, geology, and climate. 2. Provide flexibility for land and resource users to adopt land use and farming operations to adapt to and meet markets, technology, and the environmental constraints such as climate. 3. Provide for adaptation and changes in farm systems and management approaches to respond to technology, climate change, and markets. 4. Remove any reference to requiring or grandparenting farming operations to be held at historic land use, nutrient discharge levels or stocking rates implied by the provisions already discussed. And 5, ensure that requirement for specific mitigation is able to be tailored to a farm level and can provide for the future aspirations of the business and is tailored to specifically meeting the environmental risks of concern specific to the property and subcatchment. Thank you so much.
So I have some questions.
Yes, Your Honour.
Yes. Well, firstly, has your witness, Ms. Ma, proposed relief which give effect to your paragraph 44 of your submission?
Paragraph 44. Ms. Ma, as I understand, was asking for a restricted discretionary activity rule to be included, insofar as the details of that rule, there was some negotiation which took place with the Regional Council, and they were reaching some sort of agreement when the situation changed, and Your Honour, the council was directed to take a step back and provide supplementary evidence on the plan change itself.
So the court hasn't and cannot direct what regional council
yes.
The direction, the relief sought or the any amendments proposed by the regional council in the context of this hearing. But the court asked, is it a process orientated or a process yeah. plus process plus environment orientated plan? And reflecting on that, the council has come back in the draft that you've seen from Mr. the Plowsmaker, dated the 14th of March. So the court didn't direct that.
Yes, that I apologise, Your Honour.
So my question for you is, does Ms. Mars deliver on the relief that you're seeking, or is she in accordance with her, well, is she going in a slightly different direction to what you set out at paragraph 44? So that's the first question,
yes.
because sometimes people's witnesses do, and that's fine. You know, you've got yes. the advocate, you've got the witness, and, you know, then you've got two things in play, and it's just part yes. of the complexity.
In my opinion, she does, but not in as much detail as what I've gone into in my
right,
statement.
That's all I need to know. Second question is this. Now, being from Canterbury or living in Canterbury, I do understand what the concern is of dry stock farmers in Canterbury under the Environment Canterbury Plan and the perception, probably reality, that dry stock farmers are held to a nutrient budget because of various regional plans. So I understand that. I also have a good working knowledge of overseas, so I understand what you say there. With that in mind, I also appreciate that it's an important part of your relief that that where there is a change in irrigation system, at least, which will result in increased area of irrigation, that be accommodated somehow within Plan Change 7. So I understand that part of the relief, and we've had all sorts of conflicting evidence from the farming sector about that, and that's fine. Again, it's just something that, you know, we'll have to deal with. I didn't understand, and this is perhaps I don't yet understand the adverse reaction to grandparenting. And so grandparenting, by grandparenting, the objection here is that sheep and beef, while they're dry stock, but also presumably takers and users of water, be held to historic use. And that's the fundamental objection. There's a link there which I'm missing.
Yes,
so you need to
yes,
help me
I understand,
out.
And I hope that I'm answering your question articulately and intelligently. They are users of water. They mm-hmm. tend to not be quite as wholesale users of water. For example, if you look at a dairy platform on the plains, you'll see that the vast majority of it is irrigated, whereas the sheep and beef sector and also the deer sector tends to irrigate much smaller proportions of their properties, usually for a crop or for the highest yielding paddocks. That's not to say not all of them do. You will have intensive finishing operations which will. In terms of being held to the historic usage, it's not so much held to the historic usage of water quantity on its own. It's the inability to develop their irrigation at all. So if you are in a situation where you have used maybe 70% of your deemed permit, ordinarily you would still, if your consent was being reviewed, you'd probably be held for 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so much the concern. The concern is where you're seeing provisions which change, for example, your rate of take, not necessarily the volume, or which affect your area and irrigation. And grandparenting those is where we have the issue, because it completely cuts off the farmer's ability to change their systems or to adapt or to go from, for example, border dike irrigation to pivot, because your area of irrigation will change. Your rate might also change because, frankly, the take for a border dike is vastly different to what you might need for other things, especially when I'm thinking of farmers who have described to me their systems where they've got wild flood, for example. So these kinds of things which would hinder change, and we would like to see farmers moving to more efficient water use, more practices which allow them to farm within environmental limits.
But that's not the issue, though.
No.
Well, the issue for you is not that that the plan change enables farmers to use historically up to their maximum, mm-hmm. because that's what it's meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're moving in the right direction in terms of where the schedule has got to. So that's not the issue. It's not even the issue that you could change your irrigation systems. The issue is that there is not to be an increase in irrigable area. That's your issue.
That is our main
it?
Issue, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because if there's an increase in irrigable area, there may be a change in nutrients, correct? And that, so it's the dual increase area, change in nutrients, and therefore held to whatever your 2020 or 2021 environment is. That's your issue, isn't it?
To some extent, yes. Our issue is, yes, the change, not being able to change the area under irrigation, as Dr. Crystal will discuss in, for her evidence. A change in irrigation which results in greater area under irrigation
that's
doesn't
right.
necessarily result in more nutrients lost. I mean,
but it might.
It might.
And
but
that's
for example,
your injection to the nutrient.
Yes.
That's why you bring into play the experience in Canterbury of dry stock farmers there.
Not automatically necessary. That was an example where nutrients are a factor. But in Canterbury, generally, we're speaking to the experiences of dry land farmers and farmers with only a small proportion of their farm in nutrients. So the farmer A, farmer B examples, those were actually from my own consulting days where I was modelling nutrients, and farmer A was actually 220 kgs of nitrogen per hectare per year on a water dike irrigated dairy operation, and I'm not saying that this is only dairy. You will find sheep and beef farmers who are not farming within the environmental limits, and that obviously is not something we want to see as the norm. But the farmer B was actually at 15 kgs of nitrogen per hectare, and he had a partially irrigated sheep, beef, dairy grazing and cropping operation, which is a huge difference. And
yeah,
in terms of not allowing the...
I understand
yes.
that, okay, because I under... Yeah, I yeah. just do. I don't understand... and I'm going to, and I need to get to the bottom of it pretty quickly.
Sorry.
What is driving this? So, driving the interest. Is it because your submission is there cannot be a change in irrigation systems, or is it that no farmer would change and make a move to a more efficient irrigation system unless they could also then apply the same water to an increased area of land?
It's a mixture of both. They're not going to have any incentive to move to a better irrigation system
yep.
if it's going to be so hard.
And so they're not going to move to a more efficient system. And what does it mean if it's going to be so hard?
If it's going to be so hard, it's going to be difficult to get financing. And it's a cultural and emotional barrier to actually applying.
Hmm.
And then there's the cost of the non-complying activity resource consent, which is they will require experts. It may be notified.
Yeah, but okay, that's nothing I can influence.
Yes.
So
yes.
The thing is, some farmers may want to move to a more efficient system. If they move to a more efficient system, they are within the area of their historical bounds, potentially got now surplus water, which they can mm-hmm. use to irrigate. But irrigate what? The same land under the new system or new land? It's actually the new land which is driving your concern, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You want access to new land.
Yes.
And want access to new land, and then with that, then nutrient input into new land. That's why you're mentioning nutrients.
More nutrient losses from new land.
Yeah,
than
nutrient losses from new land. And so your concern with this is that it precludes that flexibility of being able to irrigate under efficient irrigation systems, mm-hmm. additional land, I guess, increase your nutrient losses.
We're not automatically saying increase nutrient losses.
Mm.
We're saying irrigate the land only rather than increase your nutrient losses. There might be some differences, but that's a separate matter. Unfortunately, water use and nutrient loss is linked, but as Dr. Crystal has explained, they don't necessarily go hand in hand if your system is reasonably efficient.
But there's no mechanism under the operative regional plan to manage that, is there, in terms of increased area resulting in no additional increased loss? And have you proposed that as a mechanism to meet your change here? If there's an increase in area, have you proposed also that there is no increase or no change in nutrient output?
Ms. Ma has made some recommendations which she can likely speak to when she's comes up to give her to speak about her evidence. But we're very wary of proposing that kind of solution, because what we've seen in Canterbury is that when people have gone for a water consent, they've been locked into their nutrients at that level, which automatically provides for a grandparented nutrient allocation system. Because once you've already got people locked in through their irrigation consent to 220 kgs per N, of N per hectare, it's very difficult to get that back from 50 resource consents sprinkled across the district. So we're very reluctant to allow nutrient modelling to factor into this kind of thing. While we do appreciate the council's concerns about managing nutrients, we think that this is more appropriate to be dealt with through the plan review, especially since we are looking at short-term resource consents for these deemed permit replacements.
So you don't oppose in principle short-term six-year consents?
No, we're not going to be opposing that any further.
Right.
Yeah.
So then your RDA, what's the purpose of that?
The purpose of that is to allow for those farmers who would like to develop their irrigation.
Is the RDA also for a period of 6 years?
Yes. Yes.
All right, understood. Call your first witness. Have you got any questions?
Yeah. Well, I did. I was just a little troubled by the fact that Ms. Ma, in her most recent statement, has an extremely confined RD. It just talks about the increase in irrigation was planned and reasonable steps to implement that increase were taken prior to 30 June 2020. So that seems to be accepting of the maximum area idea, with this one exception for the planned and reasonable steps to implement that increase.
Yes.
Prior to that date. So I was having trouble aligning that with some of your opening submission, and I just wanted to be clear what the beef and lamb position was.
Yes. So Ms. Ma's main concern is with those farmers who have already begun the process, which I think I referred to in paragraph 40. And beef and lamb's general concern is for those farmers who would like to move to more efficient irrigation infrastructure, as well as those farmers who have already embarked on the journey but have not completed.
So that's going further than what Ms. Ma has in her supplementary.
Yes, what we would...
I just needed to be very clear about that.
Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
But 6 years is still okay.
Yes, I think that that's probably been well worked through in the hearings to proceeding today.
I thought there was concern if you were making investment, there were viability concerns from lenders and so on.
We are still concerned about that, but when we asked for a longer duration, it was before the freshwater package was released, and we had serious concerns about the council's ability to complete a plan review within 6 years. However, the freshwater package has very much put a deadline on this, and the concern is somewhat alleviated.
Okay, we can follow that up.
Thank you,
Your
Honour. Your first witness. So that's Ms. Crystal, is it? Yes, Ms. Crystal.
Dr. Crystal. Call the witness.
Okay.
Some questions. So, Dr. Crystal.
Thank you.
Do you confirm that your full name is Jane Marie Crystal?
Yes.
And you've prepared a brief of evidence in chief dated 5 February 2021?
Yes.
And you've recorded your qualifications and experience in that brief of evidence?
I have.
Any corrections that you wish to make to that statement of evidence?
No.
Do you confirm that that statement of evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Now, my understanding is that you haven't participated in any of the joint witness conferencing, so you haven't signed any joint witness conferencing statements?
That's correct.
And you haven't provided any supplementary evidence? But have you prepared a summary of your evidence that you wish to read out, or do you have a summary that you wish to give of your evidence before I then ask you some questions?
Yes, I do have a summary.
If you can perhaps read that summary now.
Thank you. Tēnā koutou katoa, yep. Ko Jane Crystal, tāku inoa. Good afternoon, Your Honour, Commissioners. My name is Jane Crystal, and I'm an expert in farm systems and the impact of these systems on the environment. I just will begin by reading my executive summary, followed by paragraphs 25 and 26 related to the irrigation types in Otago, the two key points I make in my evidence, and finally I'll speak to table 4. So I'll now read my executive summary. There is an inextricable link between agricultural land uses and freshwater quality. In particular, losses of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and pathogens as indicated by E. coli from farming systems and practices to surface and groundwater can ultimately impact on the health of freshwater ecosystems. The scale and magnitude of the impacts from agriculture on freshwater depend on a range of factors, including the type of agricultural land use, scale and intensity of use, farming systems and practices, along with environmental conditions such as climate and the catchment and farm geology and topography. Some farming activities pose a higher risk of contaminant losses to water than others. These include irrigation, effluent in terms of storage, land application and management, some cropping, high stocking rates and densities, fertiliser use, including type, timing and load. However, these risks can be managed. Mitigation approaches that are tailored to the farm, including having a farm environment plan and the utilisation of farmer support tools such as soil moisture monitoring, irrigation scheduling and nutrient budgeting, are likely to result in improved outcomes and reductions in the risk of losses of contaminants to water. Taking a tailored farm and catchment approach to the management of farming systems and practices is likely to deliver greater environmental outcomes while providing for the ongoing viability of agricultural land uses, more so than the prescriptive one-size-fits-all standard or rule. Due to improved irrigation and management systems, it is entirely possible, for example, when moving from a less efficient irrigation system, such as border dike, to a more efficient irrigation system, such as centre pivot, that irrigation area can increase without an increase in nutrient losses to water from the entire farm. So I'd like to take you to paragraphs 25 and 26. The most common types of irrigation in Otago are pivot, totalling 27% of the irrigated area, and K-line or long lateral, another 27%. Flood irrigation types contribute a further 23% of the total irrigated area. According to a 2017 report on irrigated land areas in New Zealand, Otago and Canterbury are the only regions in New Zealand that have any border dike or wild flood irrigation. So I'd like to highlight two key points I make on page 10, following paragraph 31, and on page 11, following paragraph 33. The first key point is that irrigation can increase the risk of contaminant losses to water but that this risk can be successfully managed. The second key point is that the availability of contaminants for loss to water can be managed by on-farm assessment of the risks and tailored management mitigations. If you'd please turn to Table 4 on page 13, I'll talk you through this modelling work that Wheeler and Bright undertook. I'd like to reiterate two things to keep in mind when we go through this table. The first is that Otago has a significant area of flood irrigation, so that's border dike and wild flood. And my key point that contaminant losses from irrigation systems can be managed. So this table shows modelled outputs from the same farming system under the same climate with the same fertiliser, same stock, etc. And it's modelled using different irrigation types and managements, and then they modelled that on two contrasting soils. So across the top of the table, we have the modelled outputs for the two contrasting soils, a light soil on the left and a heavy soil on the right. The modelled outputs are irrigation depth in millimetres per year, drainage depth in millimetres per year, and nitrogen leaching from the root zone of kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. Down the left column, we have the model inputs of irrigation system and irrigation management options. So these are border dike, then FF, which is a fixed depth of water applied and a fixed return period, and the scenarios run with a centre pivot or travelling irrigator. FV is the irrigation event is triggered by a soil water deficit reaching a certain trigger point. That then sets off the irrigation event, and then a fixed depth was applied. The scenario run in this situation was a centre pivot. VF is when the irrigation event is on a fixed return period, so say every 10 days, but the depth of the water applied is varied to achieve a certain soil moisture target. And they ran this for a centre pivot. And then VV is when the irrigation event is triggered by a selected soil moisture deficit, and then the depth of water applied is set to achieve a certain target soil moisture. And again, that was run for centre pivot. So the results in this table illustrate several key points. The first is that different management options, so an irrigation type or irrigation scheduling management, give a large range in annual irrigation depths. And for this scenario, for example, for light soils, the range in irrigation depth was 350 to 1,465 millimetres per year, resulting in a range of drainage of 197 to 1,288 millimetres per year, and a nitrogen leaching range of 40 to 140 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. The second point is that high irrigation inputs lead to high drainage and hence high nitrogen leaching. The third is that irrigation systems and management practices can be changed to reduce the effect on drainage and nitrogen leaching. Point four is that the examples in this table indicate that lower irrigation depth, drainage, and nitrogen leaching occur when applications are controlled by soil moisture monitoring. So those were FV, VF, and VV options. For similar irrigation depths, the lighter soil has a higher drainage and therefore a higher nitrogen leaching. And in these scenarios, border dike irrigation leaches considerably more nitrogen than the other systems modelled. So these points support my position that risks and mitigations from farms are farm-specific, and that the risks of irrigation resulting in high contaminant losses to water can be managed at a farm level. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Moore.
Thank you. I want to take you back to your executive summary and paragraph 18. But before I do that, I would be assisted if you could explain to me wild flood irrigation.
Yeah. So wild flood is where often it occurs during the contours at the bottom of a hill, and there's a ditch, and the farmer will come along and put a barrier in that ditch, and then that flood just goes down over the paddock. There are no borders, and so you might have areas that are quite wet, areas that are mist completely. It's quite random.
Thank you. I had in my mind some interesting images as to what this might be, but that does make sense. Right, paragraph 18 of your executive summary, you have outlined a set of activities that pose higher risk of contaminant losses to water than others, and you've stepped through a list. Is it fair to say that in addition to irrigation, which you've mentioned in 18.1, each of those other activities that you've mentioned may occur in reliance on irrigation?
Irrigation, they can occur separate to irrigation, but irrigation, yes, it will increase the opportunity of the farmer to have higher stocking rates, change systems, therefore you have effluent, fertiliser use, and yes, and cropping. Yep.
And so when you think when you're thinking about these types of activities and the common denominator in terms of risk, as you add irrigation to these types of activities, the risk profile in terms of additional nutrient leaching increases?
It can increase. So again, it comes down to the underlying natural resource, so the soil type that that's on, the climate, and then the management of those systems.
And so when you then move through into your paragraph 19, you do start to talk about how you might mitigate some of those risks.
Mm-hmm.
You accept you can't eliminate those risks?
Can you eliminate the risks? I don't think you ever eliminate a risk unless you completely take away that. So you can eliminate the risk of high stocking rates and stocking densities by having no stock.
And you could eliminate the risk of additional nutrient leaching associated with extra irrigation areas by not having extra irrigation areas.
If it's associated with the extra irrigation areas, then yes, extra irrigation. But you could also have, you could change what you're feeding your animals, so you could bring in supplement, and therefore you would have higher stocking densities, or you could change your feed type so that it's not pasture-based, so that you've got a higher level of feed, and that would increase the risk as well. So it's not purely irrigation that increases that risk.
When you look at your list of activities as set out in your paragraph 18, irrigation would feature in terms of the risk profile for those activities.
Irrigation is one that would feature for those, but there are other ways that you could increase your stocking rates without having irrigation.
I understand that. The risk associated with irrigation is a risk of entraining contaminants beyond the root zone in the soil profile?
If there are extra contaminants on that land, if you irrigate and you're using that land to, say, grow baleage so that you can feed that out to other dry areas of your farm, and you're not actually grazing stock, then no, I don't think irrigation would necessarily cause an increase.
And what if you're applying fertiliser to that land?
Well, only if you're applying fertiliser that exceeded what the plant requirements were, or if you weren't soil moisture testing and so you actually created that drainage effect.
And in your experience in the Otago region, well, do you have experience in the Otago region modelling farms?
No, not individual farms. I've done some modelling for the Strathtyre when I worked with Ag Research, and that was my appendix too.
So when you did that modelling, did you look at any actual farm systems, or were those all hypotheticals?
They were all hypotheticals.
Now, I want to move on to the part of your evidence where you address irrigation use on sheep and beef farms. Do you have any knowledge of the percentage of sheep and beef farms where there is irrigation taking place?
No, I don't.
So, at your paragraph 22, you've set out typical uses of irrigation on sheep and beef farms in Otago. What do you base that paragraph on?
So that is based on my experiences working with the regional team and then discussions with farmers, but I don't understand, have a knowledge of the percentages of farms that they relate to.
Have you spent any time on farm in terms of sheep and beef farms in the Otago region?
Yes.
And when you think about that experience, have you observed the types of irrigation use you've set out in your paragraph 22?
I haven't observed them on lucerne crops.
So looking at that list and starting at 22.1, irrigating winter crop paddocks during the growing season to boost crop growth rates and crop yield, does that occur in, as far as you understand, for on-farm wintering?
Yes.
Does it also occur for the wintering off, so taking stock from another farm, so a dairy platform?
The grazing would occur where they're growing, so you're not talking about cut and carry.
No.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
And in your experience, what sort of sizes of winter grazing paddocks have you experienced?
An individual paddock?
Well, just in terms of your experience on sheep and beef farms, mm-hmm. What sort of areas have you observed?
I'm confused as to whether you mean the size of an individual paddock or whether you're talking about the proportion of a farm.
No, the area.
5-hectare paddock.
And when you think about those intensively grazed crops and you think about the potential for contaminant losses, do you mm-hmm. consider that activity a high-risk activity?
Winter grazing of crops is a high-risk activity, yes. Sorry, yes, I would consider it a high-risk activity.
And you do overseer modelling. That's something
yes,
you're familiar
I do.
With.
Very.
Have you modelled the loss rates associated with intensive winter grazing?
Yes, but not for Otago that I can bring to mind.
What sort of numbers might you see elsewhere in the country?
It can be anywhere up to 200 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. Thinking, but I would say that I haven't done it in the recent version. But it can be considerable.
Correct my understanding if I have it wrong, but the most recent version of Overseer is each preceding version appears to have done is showing higher and higher rates.
As we learn more, yes.
Yes. And just for the record, where, what areas of New Zealand, which regions have you undertaken your modelling?
Waikato, Canterbury, Southland, and as discussed, these ones in Otago, but those weren't actual farms. Mm.
That's the Appendix 2
yes.
assessment mm-hmm. for Strathtyre.
Yes.
Take you to your paragraph 29 now. And in that paragraph you're referring to the potential for nutrient losses to increase nutrients in the system associated with irrigating previously non-irrigated dryland areas.
Sorry, which paragraph are you on?
29. And there you step through some of the farming practices that might give rise to increased nutrient losses associated with that irrigated land?
Yes.
So increased stocking rates?
Yes.
And why does are increased stocking rates giving rise to a potential risk?
So when you increase stocking rates, you're increasing the amount of feed that's required. Feed converts into urinary N, which is excreted, and that is available for loss during leaching.
High rates of fertiliser application, why does that increase the risk?
So that increases the risk, so you could lose some direct to waterways depending where it's applied. You could lose some if it's not the rates in terms of pasture growth, so it's available for any drainage. And if you're applying irrigation and that's not successfully monitored, then that can take some of that contaminant or that nutrient through drainage as well, or in surface runoff in the case of border dyke.
Higher crop yields?
The same thing. It's the same. It's more feed in the... there's two ways, actually. So there's more feed, so you can have a higher stock rate, so you have more urinary nitrogen. The other one is that a higher crop yield, if you're grazing it in situ, you could have more animals on that crop at one time. They're there for longer, more urinary nitrogen being deposited on that bare soil, available for any potential nitrogen drainage and leaching.
And the final matter you note there is the ability to grow different crop types. So what's the connection there?
You can, it's the ability to grow crops that may have been, that may require more water. And then, so because you now have those crops, they may have higher fertiliser rates, whether they may or may not be fed to stock. If they are fed to stock, again, the yields, you know, as I said before.
Sorry, can you just run me through that again, but just take the pace a little bit slower because I'm writing notes. So the ability to grow crops that they require more water.
Yes, so you change you're changing, you could to a crop that before you couldn't grow.
Yeah.
So now it's because you were, say, water limited. And then those crops either, depending on management, might require greater fertiliser inputs. Mm. Or if they are being fed to stock, you've got the same issue with the whole stocking density and stock being on, you know, extra stock on that land with urinary nitrogen. Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah.
So you then go on in your evidence to note in your paragraph 30 that there are some management practices that can reduce the risk of water and thus nutrient loss from farming systems.
Yes.
And you then go on to explain that the type of irrigation system can also have an impact on those losses.
Yes.
So when you think about managing the potential risks associated with increased stocking rates, what's the management practice that you have in mind to manage that risk?
So the management practice for increased stocking rates. So there are multiple management mitigation strategies. It comes down to the contaminant of concern. So nitrogen we think of in terms of losses primarily through leaching, phosphorus sediment, E. coli through overland flow pathways. So if it's an overland flow pathway, you can do things like have a sediment trap or riparian planting, fencing out of waterways, not grazing or cultivating critical source areas, which are the areas in a paddock like a gully where a lot of nutrients can congregate and then there's a conduit down to a water body. For nitrogen leaching, you might change your stocking type. So, for example, a dairy cow, urine patch from a dairy cow, there's up to 1,000 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare in that patch, whereas a sheep or deer, that might be 500 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. And so when you have multiple urine patches and that slug of nitrogen is available for leaching, there's actually less in each patch if you've got a lower load, so you can reduce the risk of nitrogen leaching by changing the stock type. In terms of sediment, again, stock type, you can avoid certain areas of the farm for different times of risk. So, for example, you may not graze cattle on slopes that are at risk of erosion. So then that's your phosphorus sediment, potentially E. coli. So you might not graze the hillsides during winter. We know that urine that's deposited in autumn is quite high risk. So you might say, okay, I've got some light soil, some stony soils. I'm not going to winter graze those soils, or I'm not going to graze those soils during autumn because I know that that slug of nitrogen sits there and there's less distance for that to travel when we get a rainfall event before it hits water. So therefore I'm not going to put that slug of nitrogen in there. I might put it on a heavier soil where I know it's going to be trapped in that soil profile until the pasture or the crop comes along after our winter and has the ability to take up that nitrogen, so it's used in plant growth rather than leaching. And so all this comes down to understanding the underlying soils and geology and then the farming system and tailoring that individually to the individual farm situation.
So the mitigation steps that you have outlined might reduce the risk, but they won't necessarily eliminate those risks.
That's correct.
Do you then go on to discuss how the type of irrigation system can also assist with, you say, reduction or elimination of surface runoff?
Yes.
And reduction in leaching volumes, referring again to the moisture monitoring type tools.
Yes.
In your experience, how widespread is moisture monitoring in the Otago region?
I don't know.
You go on in your paragraph 33 to provide some further mitigation in terms of these risks, including matching fertiliser inputs to plant and crop demand.
Yes.
And then you pick up at 33.2 the matching of stocking rates to the natural capital of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And strategic grazing of winter crops.
Yes.
So all quite bespoke and nuanced mitigations required in order to manage the effects of irrigation of land?
Yes.
Now I want to move on now to the part of your evidence where you discuss the potential nutrient leaching implications associated with a change of from dry land to irrigated farmland.
Yep.
And there are two components to this. The first is the study that you've attached at Appendix B to your evidence, and then there's the Brighton Wheeler information that you referred to in your summary. So let's start with your Appendix B. And having considered that document and read your evidence, do you accept the proposition that the increase in the change from irrigated to, I'll start that again, the change from dry land to irrigated farm systems has resulted in your modelling in an increase in nutrients in relation to a number of the scenarios that you have examined?
Yes, changing from dry land to irrigated has resulted in my modelling in an increase.
Has resulted in a what increase?
In my modelling, in the modelling I undertook, it has resulted in an increase in nutrient losses to water.
And for people like me who like pictures, the graphs that are in your Appendix B start to give an indication of what those changes look like. So if we turn to your Appendix B and page 10 of that document, Mm-hmm. And your figure four there is the modelled loss rates for different blocks in a possible future sheep and beef irrigated scenario.
Yes.
Across the range of the soil types in the Strathtyre.
Yes.
And when you analyse that graph, there's an increase associated with each of the irrigated options compared to the non-irrigated.
Just pause for a second. This is figure four. I wasn't actually sure how to read figure four, sorry.
Okay.
It's like, do you get that out of figure four? But I didn't, so perhaps you could step us through, the Kamako clay soils.
Okay, so within the overseer modelling, we get nutrient losses per block, so... I had the different systems in there, and then what I've done here is given the block losses, and also in the green the average whole farm loss. What I did when I had that each farm with its different blocks, I then changed the soil types to the predominant soils in that region, so that all those blocks are under, so that glay, Kamako glay. And so what this graph is showing us is that the irrigated sheep kale, regardless of soil type, has quite high losses.
I see. Okay, so I can see where my problem might come. I'm not differentiating between your two blues.
Yes.
I think my dryland sheep lucerne looks pretty much like the same colour as the irrigated sheep kale.
Okay.
So I'm going, it's all
the same.
It's all pretty spiky.
Okay,
yeah.
So then the in each soil type, the first
blue
is your dryland sheep lucerne, and that second one, which is considerably higher in each soil type, is irrigated sheep kale.
Okay. That's really helpful. Now I can understand why Mr. Moore asked you the question. All right. So with that in mind, now that I can read this,
Yes, so the pattern which becomes apparent when the colours are reconciled in the graph is what is. I must confess I had to look carefully at those two blues. The pattern that becomes apparent is that the irrigated use results in a higher nitrogen leaching estimate than the non-irrigated scenario.
Yes, except that you should actually be comparing dryland sheep lucerne with irrigated sheep lucerne and not a lucerne with a kale.
And you can't grow kale without water? You have to irrigate that crop, don't you, or not?
Possibly. Probably to get the yields. And as I say, I don't have specific knowledge growing in... Otago, so I'm not sure.
So you meant to compare dryland lucerne with irrigated lucerne, and dryland pasture with irrigated pasture.
Yes.
And irrigated sheep kale kind of standing out there as an exception in its own right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the main point with looking at the is to look at the whole farm. So you can say, yes, that irrigated, that kale is quite high loss, but it depends entirely on the proportion of the farm that is under that management system, because when you then look at the whole farm losses, and quite often in extensive sheep and beef farms where they do have a component of a winter crop, you can apply quite a lot of effort into reducing those emissions from that block, but it actually doesn't reduce your overall farm losses by much because it's such a small percentage of the farm.
And so for each of the colours on the bar graph, that's a block of dryland sheep, not dryland sheep, a block of dryland lucerne, a block of irrigated lucerne, a block of pasture, which is dryland and pasture, another block for irrigated pasture, and another block for irrigated kale. Is that how it works?
Yes, but
so you've got five blocks, and
yes,
then you've got the
total,
farm.
And with the understanding that the what is in that whole farm bar.
Yeah, it also includes those.
It includes everything else, nothing else. So this is the entire. This is everything that's in the green bar is broken down into those other ones. There isn't anything missing from this graph.
What do we compare the green bar to? Is there an unirrigated versus irrigated whole farm on that graph, or is it?
If you go back to page 8, the green bar is the orange bar.
Page 8?
Sorry, page 8, figure 2.
And so now the green bar is?
The orange bar, I'm sorry. So that this green bar, so this graph here was this future sheep and beef scenario where we had the increased irrigation area, and that becomes this orange bar. And so when we compare in figure 2.
Figure 2, yeah, okay. So now that's whole farm.
And then, so this is whole farm, yes. And then, so the original dry land, what we call dry land, but they did have a small component of irrigation, is the blue. And then we looked at what would happen when we increase the area of irrigation, and that changes it to the orange. And then I looked at a dairy farm for comparison of, you know, taking it the whole way to intensificate, you know, a more intensive system. And what this shows us is that at that time there was a 30 kilograms of nitrogen limit. And the soil type has a huge impact on those overall losses. So these are exactly the same systems, but different soil types.
Now you've lost me, I'm afraid. So looking at figure 3.
Figure 2.
Right, that's possibly why. Because that's got... I see it's the blue compared to the...
Orange.
Orange.
So the blue is your original dry land, although there was a small component of irrigation in that. And that orange is what we were looking at as green. In figure 4.
Oh, I see. So this might usefully be seen as a summary graph of...
Yes.
That's helpful. So I can put... And I was going to look at the dairy graph as well in your figure 5, which shows a similar pattern, but we can cut to the chase in your figure 2.
Yes, we can cut to the chase in figure 2, yes.
So each of the scenarios modelled shows an increase in nitrogen loss compared to the dryland farming system.
Yes.
Oh, whilst we're thinking about it. Oh, no, you can finish your questions. Oh. And I was going to have...
Was it on those, in that part of the appendix, you had a question? Or?
Well, I was... So this is overseer modelling.
Yes.
Applying the standard farm management practices, I've forgotten what they call them, mitigation practices, which are part of overseer.
So overseer assumes good management practice.
Yes, so that's been applied to get these figures.
Yes.
But none of the other management techniques that you talk about in your evidence are necessarily brought to bear on this.
That's correct.
Right, okay.
Now, let me test that answer.
Yep.
So, for example, the fertiliser application, my understanding of the way Overseer works is that it assumes the correct application of fertiliser rate.
No.
So actual fertiliser...
So the user has to input fertiliser application.
So for the purposes of your examples that you have tracked through and put in the summary graph, you are assuming good management practices?
In good management practices in terms of the application of the fertiliser. So so Overseer automatically assumes that you are applying your fertiliser evenly, it's not being applied over a waterway, etc.
Right, so the mitigation options that you were discussing in terms of reducing the risks of fertiliser are assumed then in the overseer modelling?
The ones for where it's applied, not the one where you're tailoring the level of overseer fertiliser to the plant growth, that then you would be inputting the amount of fertiliser that was applied.
So on the Wilkins example, remember the Wilkins appeal, and we control the amount of fertiliser input, that was because Overseer wasn't doing it And so we said, I think it was 50 kg or whatever it was per annum, based on advice from the relevant fertiliser sector. So that those inputs aren't here, I don't think. There's very, not a terrible amount in terms of what is recommended by way of good management practice and what is inputted or assumed by good management practice in overseer, is there? I mean, your evidence goes well beyond that good management practice. It does, doesn't it?
And yeah. Particularly for losses via overland flow. So overseer isn't spatially explicit. So a lot of the things that we do is, you know, to protect those critical source areas, and overseer just doesn't do that.
No.
It's modelling that which goes down, not that which goes across.
It gives a bit of a guess.
Which is, again, and why in Wilkins we didn't go with the P output for overseer. So Wilkins is an appeal. South from Regional Council in Wilkins. I don't know whether you want to look at it or not, but a lot of these issues were tested through there.
Now, was that the... That was the...
That was it.
But yep. Just that
yep.
juncture?
Yeah, just exactly what good management practices were in.
Yeah.
That's... Yep, I understand that.
Right. The next proposition that I wish to explore with you... So, to wrap up, the part of your evidence we've just been discussing, your Otago region-specific modelling shows an increase in nitrogen loss associated with a change to either an irrigated sheep and beef or an irrigated dairy compared to dry land?
In this scenario, yes.
And now you have then referred to some work by Wheeler and Bright from 2015, and you took the court through Table 4 in relation to the Wheeler and Bright 2015 report?
Yes.
Can you tell me what the farm system that was modelled comprised of in that situation?
I'll have to check. I'm not sure if... I don't recollect... if they outlined it in the paper. I have the paper here. I'm just having a look. So I have the... it was a block receiving 600 millimetres rainfall, irrigated between October and March. And then for the light soil, that's a plant available water of 49 millimetres to 600 millimetres, or the heavy soil was a plant available water of 103 millimetres. But there is no information as to what the stocking rate or what stocking type or anything like that.
So having looked at the paper, there's no explanation as to the farming system that has been used in that example?
No. So the absolute losses, you can't... As with overseer, you can't use an absolute loss for anything anyway. But the relativity, because the farming system and the managements were identical, the relativity between the scenarios is relevant.
What was the purpose of that paper?
The purpose of that paper was to explain the new irrigation component of overseer.
So it wasn't a paper about looking at the comparative differences between systems. The differences that were produced in that paper were simply for illustrative purposes of the new irrigation module within Overseer.
Yes, so it was designed to... the paper's purpose was to explain the way the model interprets... The losses from those systems.
And the paper itself notes that the situations to be is simply for illustrative purposes.
Yes.
And so great care needs to be taken in seeking to use that information for a different purpose.
Yes.
And the paper goes on to note that the effects of management rules will depend on climate and soil characteristics.
Yep.
And the annual rainfall number of 600 millimetres that was used in this example, have you compared that to the annual rainfall that occurs in the Otago region?
No, because I was commenting predominantly on the comparison between the irrigation types, because short of modelling all farming systems in the region.
Do you accept that the outcomes from the modelling may change significantly if the rainfall parameter is changed in the modelling?
If the rainfall parameter is changed, then and the soil plant available water remains the same, then yes, there would be the irrigation would be less. It would automatically, because the model says, well, what is required to take that soil back up to field capacity. The only one that might not change is actually border dike.
And what happens if it goes the other way? There's more rainfall, say, in the shoulder seasons than field capacity.
If there's more rainfall and it has irrigated and it hasn't dropped below field capacity, then you're going to have surface runoff or drainage.
And that's where the risk of extra nutrient leaching arises.
Yes, which is why you would do an assessment and why you have soil moisture monitoring.
In your experience, even without irrigation in the shoulder seasons, can field moisture levels be exceeded?
I couldn't comment for Otago.
The paper also notes that soil characteristics are important.
Absolutely.
And that only a small subset of possible options is shown in what is Table 3, which you've brought through into your evidence as Table 4.
Yep. Yes.
I wonder whether I might have you produce this document to add to the...
Is this part of the common bundle, or is this part of the... What are you saying?
Probably as an exhibit.
Okay.
Yes.
So we'll just have the witness check the document, confirm that she's familiar with the document. You certainly sound like you are, but just make sure that this is the document that you had in mind.
Yes.
It is. Okay. And is there any objection to the production of this document as an exhibit to your witnesses referring to it?
There's not.
No. Okay. So we'll... Produce that document as exhibit Beef and Lamb 1, a paper entitled Irrigation in Overseer, authors Wheeler and Bright. So that's exhibit Beef and Lamb 1.
And just so that the court understands the part of the document that we've been discussing, if you'd turn to page 5, you'll see a heading example outputs, and at the end of the first paragraph under that heading you'll see it is also important to note that these examples have been set for illustrative purposes only, and that the effects of management rules will depend on climate and soil characteristics, and only a small subset of possible options is shown in Table 3.
Right, you can see that written there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
In your experience modelling farming systems, have you been engaged to prepare comparative overseer analyses to demonstrate the potential effects of increased areas of irrigation?
Only in for this document here.
Right. So
this
was...
is Appendix 2 for the Strathtyre.
So that was your essentially your modelled hypothetical examples which show the increases?
Yes.
Take you to paragraph 47, which I think is your concluding paragraph. And there you say that irrigation can be conducted without significant negative impacts on nitrogen leaching. And it's important that systems are considered on a case-by-case basis.
Yes.
Now, is that because of the bespoke mitigations that will need to be applied in relation to each farming system need to be very carefully matched to each farm system to ensure that the reductions that might occur?
Yes. So the mitigations need to be tailored to the farm and an understanding of that farming system, the proportion of the farm that is under irrigation, the impacts on farming system and change to farming practices that irrigation will result in, all these need to be assessed, in my belief.
When you think about the effects of nutrient runoff and also nitrogen leaching in a whole of farm system, do you accept it's not just as simple as seeking to balance the overseer books in terms of the mass load of nutrients, but rather the location from which nutrients might be discharged is also important?
Yes. So I guess I spoke before about looking at your vulnerable soils, but then I'm thinking that you were talking about attenuation and the fact that overseer, and we're looking at what comes out the bottom of the root zone, and then there is a difference there in terms of what leaves the root zone and then what you see in a water body, and there's different levels of attenuation, and that's an area of understanding or that I don't have in terms of the attenuation factors.
And overseer doesn't take into account the sensitivity of receiving water bodies?
No, it doesn't.
And so the link between location and a sensitive water body is simply not something considered when comparative overseer modelling is undertaken?
No, and again, that comes back to with your farm plan, so you need to actually understand the receiving water bodies and what is the contaminant of concern. And overseer, the other thing with overseer is that it is only looking at nitrogen and phosphorus. It's not looking at sediment or E. coli. So those sorts of things need to be done at a farm level.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Re-examination.
With your permission.
Absolutely.
Just a few questions.
Yep.
Thank you.
So you have to follow on from Mr. Moore's questions, so that's your comment.
Yes.
Yep. And
yes.
Then the court will ask its own questions, but now's the time to ask.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Dr. Crystal, earlier you were taking the court and Mr. Moore through some figures in your Appendix 2, namely figures 2, 3, 4 and 5, which were comparing dry land sheep pasture, kale, lucerne, so on and so forth, with irrigated land uses.
Yes.
And you were remarking on the differences. So I would just like some clarification, please. What is the difference between dry land and irrigated?
You're talking about a figure in particular or not?
Figures 2, 3, 4 and 5. Your Honour.
Mm. And what do you mean in terms of what is the difference?
What is if one is talking about dry land or we're talking about irrigated land use, for example, in your figures,
mm-hmm.
What is dry land and what is irrigated?
Right, so for this, what we're calling dry land, this was a farming system that had a proportion of irrigated land in it, and then the irrigated situation. Let me read through. So I'm going to section 3.2.1. That current system, that was an 860 hectare farm. It had 709 hectares of dry land, and 137 hectares of irrigated pasture. Then with that future sheep and beef farm, that was the dryland pasture reduced to 483 hectares and irrigated pasture was increased to 349. So I guess what most commonly we are not, sheep and beef properties don't most commonly irrigate 100% of their property.
Thank you.
Sorry, and I should say, when I'm saying sheep and beef, I am also including deer, just in all my comments here.
Okay. Commissioner, have you got any questions?
No, I don't.
Have you got any questions? And so your evidence has made... in some detail explain the measures which can be taken to reduce the likelihood of loss of N or P as a consequence of irrigation. And there are a large number of mechanisms which you describe in your evidence and also in response to Mr. Moore's line of questioning. I don't see any of that in the being proposed by sheep and beef, beef and lamb. And I'm just wondering, can you comment on that? Whether there should be an increase elsewhere in the country what's a sensible outcome here? If there is to be an increase in air of the area of land under irrigation, should there also be a drive to ensure that farmers employ those tools which are available to them to reduce the losses of contaminants, which, as you say, it's not just N and P, and it's not also just E. coli and sediment. There's a range of losses.
Yes, so I think farmers really need to understand their land and their underlying capital and the inherent risks and also opportunities of their particular farm and the land that they're on, the climate that they're under, and then have an environmental farm plan that looks at the within the catchment, so the understanding of the receiving bodies, but also looks at the risks that land, and then the farming system, and looking at those areas that they can, where they can mitigate the risks. And I think I also believe that it needs to be a not a tick box. So it needs to be farm specific, and the farmer needs to be involved and have the buy into the whole system and the whole process. Because my experience, so I facilitated a group of deer farmers for over 3 years, an environmentally focused group, and I found that when farmers understand the risks and understand the loss pathways and what causes those risks, they actually come up with mitigations that those of us that might sit behind a desk don't think of. And I'm very nervous when it comes to having a checklist of these other mitigations. I think that as a whole the sector benefits when farmers understand those loss pathways and understand what the risk factors are, and then innovation occurs, and and farmers often come up with mitigations, and we see them a lot. So, for example, there's some farmers in the Pomahaka, and they understood the mechanisms of losses of sediment and phosphorus from crop, and they had some screens up to capture that sediment before it reached your water body, and then they were applying it, and they were getting benefits. They understood that that sediment's high in nutrient, and that's a natural fertiliser. You don't want to lose your topsoil. So it's actually engaging with farmers, making it about their farm, and understanding the pathways, and then farmers themselves come up with some solutions.
No, and I tend to agree with you, including also that it should not just be the regional council that says do this, like, you know, fence 3 metres off a waterway, and so farmers do that at huge cost and then still wonder why they've got a problem, and the problem is they're not actually engaging with the whole of the system. So those simple solutions can engender a great deal of community resentment when the results aren't seen within the environment. Okay, so you're not, anyway, you're not advocating or supporting an increase in irrigable area with a potential increase in nutrient or contaminant losses without also having a look at the range of measures which can be brought to bear to lessen the likelihood of that.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. Thank you very much for your evidence. It was really, it was a very interesting read, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to take a break for 15 minutes. Yep.
Please all stand.